And he's a ne'er of him who finds his bosom glow with love.
I ask that the reading out of Isaiah be read for tonight again, though we're actually out of the book of Isaiah. But I wanted to call your attention again to that statement that he would gather his lambs in his arms and carry them in his bosom and would gently lead those who are with young. In addition to that picture, will you listen to this picture that Jesus gave in the 23rd chapter of Matthew when he said, O Jerusalem, Jerusalem, how often would I have gathered your children together as a hen gathers her brood under her wing? But you wouldn't. And then in Luke, the 15th chapter, the parable of the prodigal son, where Jesus said that this father saw his prodigal returning, and while he was yet afar off, he ran and fell upon his neck and kissed him much. And then that strange Old Testament statement in the book of Zechariah, chapter 7 and verse 11, where the picture is given there of a father, God speaking, urging his children, Israel, to live right. And it says they turned the shoulder away and stopped their ears that they might not hear. You might ask, what common thread is there between all of these very remotely related passages? First of all, there's a picture in each one of them that I think will show you the connection. The picture of the shepherd carrying lambs in his bosom and putting them in his arms. The picture of a hen gathering her brood under her wings. The picture of a loving father running and falling upon the neck of a wandering, wayfaring son and kissing him much, embracing him. The picture of a father standing and talking with his son with his arm on his shoulder and the son turning away. The common thread among all of these verses is simply this. It tells us that God is a God who touches. Now, I don't know whether that means anything to you or not. If you'll think about it, I think it does. It tells us that God is a God who touches. And you say, well, what is there important about it? It's escaped me. Do you not see the importance of the touch? I think you do. The importance of simply the gesture that reaches out and accepts and acknowledges someone else for what they are, and many times in spite of what they are. We've learned through experience and through scientific research that the touch of a mother on her infant baby is of utmost importance. It's best if she can nurse the baby. The physical contact, the embrace that this provides is essential to a child's well-being. If she can't nurse him, doctors recommend that if you feed him with a bottle, be sure you hold that baby and not just prop the bottle up on a pillow, but hold him and cuddle him and embrace him and caress him. Many a child has been made to feel 1,000% better when his mother says, well, come on, baby, let mama kiss it. And he's hurt himself and he comes screaming to his mother or to his daddy, and we say, well, come on, John or Jack or Pete, come on, let daddy kiss it. And if he's very little, he will. If he's not, he gets embarrassed about it. Do you get a message when someone refuses to shake hands with you? You know, when you say shake hands and make up, no, I'm not going to do it. You get the impression that they don't want to have anything to do with you yet. Or the message that's given by a wife when she says to her husband, don't you ever touch me again. And it's usually in staccato, ta-da-ta-ta-ta, you know. It isn't always permanent. She means don't ever, not ever, ever, but just right now, ever. But anyway, the message is clear and simple. What a different message you got this week when you met people whom you have not seen for maybe 2 or 3 years or maybe 10 years. And they return for the reunion, for homecoming day, and friends reach out and grab each other and embrace and shake hands with such gusto, you know, that it just, it's great. Or when a wife and husband have been separated for months, his being in the war, her being at home, and whenever she meets the airplane and she runs and falls into his arm and embraces him, what a beautiful picture that is, showing us that the physical touch is something that's so very, very important. And that's why I think this is important tonight. When Jesus came to show us God, he came to show us this in a very genuine, intimate way. When he came to show us God, he came to a people who had become accustomed to not touching pretty well anybody. John, in the very outset of his gospel, lets it be known that the Jews have no dealings with the Samaritans. And the Samaritan woman was surprised, and she said, "How is it that you, being a Jew, ask a drink from me, a Samaritan woman?" And the Jew not only would not associate with the Samaritans, the Jew who was a religious person, the religious Jew would not think of associating with those that were sinners. On one occasion, Jesus was in the home of Simon the Pharisee. And Simon was a very proper man. He was the kind of man that had been shocked by Jesus not washing his hands before he ate. And on this one occasion, while Jesus was eating in this man's house, as he was reclining at table, it says there came in a street woman, a woman of the city. In other words, there came in a prostitute, a woman of ill repute. And she came in distraught and knelt beside Jesus back by his feet and began to cry. And her tears fell down on his feet. And more or less, perhaps even to apologize, she took her hair and wiped the feet of those tears. And she anointed them with an ointment, and she kissed his feet. And Simon sat there astonished, appalled, and he said, "I know now this man is no prophet. If he were, he would not have let this woman touch him. If he had known what kind of woman she was, he would not have let her touch him." When the Pharisee and the publican went up to pray, the publican knew where his place was. You know, the Pharisee and the publican were all right as long as each one would keep his place. The Pharisee thought, yeah, the publican is fine as long as he'll just stay in his place way over yonder. And so in Luke 18, when these two men went up to the temple to pray, it says the Pharisee was praying there in the temple, and it implies in the temple proper. But it implies then also, it says it, that the publican stood afar off, way on away from this man, because you see, he knew that he wasn't accepted. He knew that this Pharisee hated his guts, really. In fact, he was standing there praying aloud, "I'm glad I'm not like that man." The Pharisee let it be known, and the publican got the message that this church man didn't really have much to do. He didn't really want to touch him. There was what was called in those days, and I forget the exact phrase, but there were some scribes that were called the black and blue boys, the black and blue scribes. You know why? They were of such a nature that they had nothing to do with women whatsoever. And whenever a woman would actually come walking down the street, though they would be covered except perhaps for one eye, these black and blue scribes were noted for just closing their eyes. Here comes a woman. And of course, they'd run into posts and into anything else that was in the way. And they actually gained this title of the black and blue men, because they always had these whelps, you know, and knots and kernels and all, because they didn't want to touch or be associated with anything as lowly as a woman. That's the kind of people we find Jesus coming to. We find him also speaking against those who could be called the theologians of their day, the lawyers and the scribes, perhaps the professors of the day. He said, "You load men with grievous burdens hard to be borne, but you yourself will not touch one of the burdens with one of your fingers." And he lashed out against those who were so keen in their academic pursuits, not so much academic, but in their theological dissertations and all, that they would load these things up on the people who were their disciples, and yet they went their merry way. And when the people cried out for a little help, it just simply said, "Buzz off, I can't be bothered. You just do what I say. Don't do like I do, and don't ask me to help you do what I say. They were a kind of people who had developed such a social disconnection or social disinterestedness that they were able to pass by on the other side when people were lying on the side of the road bleeding and nearly dead. Jesus told the parable. But the parable that Jesus told about the Good Samaritan and about how the priest and the Levite actually passed this man by who was in need, that was just an illustration of what he had been asked by the lawyer when the lawyer said, "Well, who is my neighbor?" Jesus had just got through saying, "Love your neighbor as you love yourself." And this man, trying to justify himself and get out of a tight situation, said, "Well, but who is my neighbor?" And then Jesus told him about the man that had been bypassed on the side of the road leading down from Jerusalem to Jericho. But that was just the illustration. He was talking about the kind of action that was those people's custom, who simply left people hanging on the side of the road, lying there half dead, lacking the social kindnesses extended by other people, lacking the social graces that are just common, should be common between people because they're human people, human beings. And he said, "You're wrong." And he gave them this reprimand and gave them this rebuke because they were the kind of people who just let people lie there and die because of a lack of plain common kindness in the all of human kindness. The last 10 days of the life of Jesus, Luke records that he was on his way up from Jericho to Jerusalem. And there was a blind man sitting there. His name was Bartimaeus. And this blind man heard the commotion and he said, what is all the noise? And someone said, "It's Jesus of Nazareth passing by." And this man began to say, "Jesus, thou son of David, have mercy on me." And one of them had the gall to say, "Shut up, Bartimaeus. He doesn't have time to fool with somebody like you." I don't know what their exact words were, but it just simply says that they rebuked him. And that's a very strong word. They rebuked him and they said, "Be quiet." After all, they weren't blind. And they couldn't understand why this man wanted help so urgently. But they never had been blind. Or they couldn't understand why Jesus went into the home of Zacchaeus. But they never had been ostracized from society. And when he went into the home of Zacchaeus that same day or in that same town, they couldn't understand. And it says they criticized him because he went into the home of this man and touched him socially. We find that these people among whom Jesus came were people who loved those who loved themselves. But they hated those who hated them. And they found themselves possessing no social grace that would make them be enabled to love people who didn't love them, or to be kind to those people who were unkind to them. That's the kind of people that Jesus came among. It was this kind of a dichotomy, this kind of a separation, this kind of a rupture in society and in the social relations among a nation of people that produced this wide gulf, this wide chasm between those who were the up and ins and those who were the down and outs. And as a result, there developed a whole class of people who actually felt like that they'd been passed by. And they actually felt like that nobody really cared. And those who were the respectable people in the community wouldn't touch them. They wouldn't have anything to do with them. And there developed then, as a result of this resentment, reservation, this kind of an arm's length, hands-off social concept, and this religious unbearableness where they would not tolerate each other. And they developed this animosity and antagonism to where there was almost a powder keg situation that Jesus Christ came into. They had come, or he had come into a situation or a society that had learned to not touch anybody. And they were sick. And it was showing itself in the way they related themselves to each other. That's why when Jesus Christ came, he came as such an oddball. When he came to show us God, he came touching people. Touching them. They thronged in response to him. Luke says that they thronged him so much that people could not discern, or he couldn't discern, who it was that had touched him. He was on his way one day to the house of Jairus, the ruler of the synagogue, whose little 12-year-old girl was at the point of death. And while he was going, a woman who had had a hemorrhage for 18 years came and said, "If I can only touch his garment." And unknown to anybody else, she came up and touched his garment, and she was healed. But Jesus, sensing that power had gone from him, said, "Who was that that touched me?" Peter said, Lord, the crowd is pressing upon you. The multitude is all around you. How can you ask who is it that touched you? And this simply gives us an indication of the kind of man Jesus was. He was out among the throng. He was out there rubbing elbows with the people who needed him. He was out there in such a congestion that maybe he had to shoulder his way and elbow his way through the crowded streets, and the people that were thronging about him were up against him, so that Peter said, Lord, how in the world can you know who touched you? Look at them. They're all over the place. It became such an urgent thing, or it became such a practice, that he had to actually one day to get into a boat to keep from being crushed by the crowd. That's the kind of man that he was. On another occasion, Matthew says in the Gospel of Matthew, he said that Jesus and his disciples were in a boat and they came across the sea and landed at a place called Gennesaret. And that they got out of the boat, and when the men of the region saw who it was, they sent out a message and rounded up all the sick people and brought them to Jesus. There was the blind and the halt and the lame and the maimed, and those who had leprosy, and those who were dumb, and those who had dropsy and palsy, those who had issues of blood, those who had all these terrible diseases. And here they came, crutches, pallets, stretchers, whatever it was that it took to get these people to Jesus. The garbled mumbling of people who couldn't talk. The blind stumbling around wanting to touch him. And it says, and as many as touched him were healed. But he allowed people to touch him. And these people weren't used to that. They were accustomed to people backing off, you know, and saying, don't you dare touch me. And they were accustomed to people whenever the shadow, for example, of a Samaritan fell upon a Jew. If he was a religious Jew, he would hurry home horrified and would take off his clothes and would bathe entirely and put on new clothes because he had been defiled by a Samaritan. That's what they were accustomed to. And when this man came, touching, being touched, elbowing, rubbing elbows, and just associating with every kind of person on the face of the earth, they just didn't quite know how to receive him. They wanted him to touch their little babies. Luke says in Luke 18, they brought their little babies, the mothers did, and more or less you could see them standing in line wanting Jesus just simply to handle and touch and bless their little babies. And his disciples said, get those babies out of here. Jesus said, don't do that. Let them alone. You let them come to me. Don't forbid the little children to come to me, for of such is the kingdom of heaven. And then he took those little babies in his arms, and I can just imagine him kissing them. Did you ever pick up a baby you didn't kiss? I don't guess I have either. I bet Jesus didn't either. It says he put his hands upon them, he touched them, and he blessed them. But it wasn't just those who were like babies, who were lovable ones that he touched. Jesus touched the untouchables. In Matthew, the 8th chapter, after he came down from the mount and teaching the Sermon on the Mount, it says, there came a man up to him who was a leper, whom custom had relegated as one of the outcasts. And as far as custom was concerned, he was supposed to have stayed a certain number of paces back from the Lord, and he may have, crying, Tame, Tame, unclean, unclean. And this man, though it seems as though he broke the bounds of custom and came up to Jesus and said, you can heal me if you wish. You can make me clean. And it says Jesus was moved with compassion. Do you know why he was moved with compassion? I cannot help but believe that he must have looked at this man whose bandages or his clothes were more or less just bandages to hold his flesh together. And the stench of this man, if you were downwind of him, was tremendous. The leper didn't smell very good. He didn't look very good. He was one of the outcasts of society. I don't doubt but what when Jesus looked at him and thought, I wonder how long it's been since anyone has touched you. And he had compassion on him. And he says, I will. I do want to make you clean. And it says he reached out his hand and he touched him. I would think that if the man had not even been healed, the very fact that someone loved him enough just simply to reach out and touch him would have meant an awful lot to him. Jesus says, or the Bible says, that he touched people who were deaf. In Mark the 7th chapter, it says that he put his fingers in the ears of those that were deaf. Have you ever put your finger in someone else's ear? Tried. Yick, I don't want to. But Jesus did, put his fingers in their ears. It says he touched their tongues. He actually touched their tongues. That's in Mark 7. Have you ever touched anybody else's tongue? He did. It says he touched their eyes, of those that were blind. Did you ever go up and touch a blind person's eyes? Jesus did. It says that he washed the feet of men who were arguing about who was the greatest in the kingdom. That he took a towel and got a basin of water and sat down or kneeled in front of them and put their dirty feet in the water and ran his hands, no doubt, around their feet to wash the dirt off and then took the towel and dried them. Did you ever wash anybody's feet? Jesus did. You remember Malchus, servant of the high priest, when they came out to arrest Jesus? Jesus not only touched those who were his friends and who were those who were in need, he touched those who were his enemies. Peter cut Malchus' ear off. Jesus reached over and touched that bloody stump and healed his ear. Oh, but he was an enemy. Jesus didn't have any enemies. And he knew that everybody had a need to be touched. So he touches us in our needs. He touches our hearts. He touches us socially. He touches us spiritually. Jesus touched us every way imaginable in this social contact that lets us know that he really and truly cares. And there came to be then this resurging, residual, overwhelming, recurring impression that continued to be made and mount up and continue to mount in size and in impact, that simply said, this man cares. This man cares. And so finally in the Hebrew writer, someone made the statement in the Hebrew letter. The writer there says, we don't have a high priest that can't be touched with the feelings of our weaknesses, but one who has been in all points tempted like as we are and yet without sin. We have a high priest that can be touched with the feelings of our weaknesses. Simon Peter said in 1 Peter 7 and verse, or 5 and verse 7, he says, casting all your anxieties upon him because he cares for you. He cares about you. Simon had been with him when he had seen him raise the son of the widow of Nain, raise him from the dead. He had been with him when he had seen all these other things that had happened and how he had gone out and was touched by others and touched others and allowed himself to be at their disposal. And Simon Peter wrote from personal experience when he says, you can cast all your anxieties on him. He really cares about you. And that's the lesson that we get from this passage and from these related passages, that Jesus Christ, when he came to show us God, showed us a God who touches people. I've said this over and over, and I think it still to be the most powerful impression that's ever been made on my mind. Jesus had an unfailing, inexhaustible capacity to receive people to himself and to say to them, in essence, come on, I want you with me. I don't know how we can withstand such a personality as that. But I wonder if there's not a lesson in it for us. You know, he not only was that way himself. He says, if you're going to be my disciples, you're going to have to be that way. He told the parable of the Good Samaritan and said, this is what I want you to do. And as he told how this man was moved with compassion, as the others had left him by and they couldn't care less, they had something else more important. This man had important business too, no doubt. Everybody's business is important to him. But he forewent and he let go by what he had as his own likes, and he stopped and showed mercy to this man who was on the side of the road. And he bound up his wounds and he poured on them oil and wine, and he set him on his beast and carried him to an inn and paid for it with his money. Jesus said, I want you to go and do likewise. This man was a toucher of humanity. He stopped and touched him. You can't bind up wounds without touching them. You can't wash feet without touching them. You can't heal the blind and raise the dead and do all these things. You don't do things like that without touching people, either literally or figuratively. And when he gave the picture of the last judgment, you know who it was that he said would be admitted into the eternal kingdom? These touchers, the ones who touch people. He said, come, you blessed of my Father, inherit the kingdom prepared for you from the foundation of the world. Who? Those who touched people in their thirst. Those who gave something to drink to the thirsty and fed the hungry and clothed the naked and ministered to the sick and visited those in prison. These people who were out touching people, who were letting themselves be concerned about the cares and the needs of other people, who were letting themselves care about the needs of other people. They extend themselves. They touch other people. Jesus said they're the people that are going to get to heaven. And he said, those who are not going to make it to heaven, I don't care how religious, he says, you are the ones who don't touch people, who can't be moved, who can't find themselves being drawn into the situation of people to where they are absolutely forced by the sheer force of their own heart and their own emotions and their own love for the well-being of other people and their desire for that well-being. They cannot be moved to touch anybody. And they stand back and they build walls around them and they separate themselves from people and they ostracize and they push away and they keep at arm's length and they have hands-off policy and hands-off religion. Jesus said, you're not going to make it. You're not going to make it into heaven. History has always taught us and shows that there's a tendency among people to always get out of touch with humanity. The Anglican Church of England, to me, is one of the most pathetic organizations in the whole world. It's not just that recently, but as long as more than 250 years ago, the Anglican Church was so out of touch with people. They had become so high church that there came a rupture within that organization, and out of it came Methodism, John and Charles Wesley, who insisted that they minister in a simple way to simple people. Out of it also came the Salvation Army, and Major Booth, who insisted that while the Church of England in its high church theology and all of its liturgy and all of its falderal and all of that business that really doesn't touch people, Booth said, we've got to get out and start ministering to the needs of these people who are the forgotten ones. I wonder how many communes, religious communes, have been started by people who are religious people, but who just simply get the feeling that nobody cares and that they simply are left out in the cold, and yet they're here among people, but they don't have any, there's no interchange. There's no sense of receiving and giving. There's no sense of genuine concern. And they've then banded together and said, let's get together and have our own. And they go off somewhere and they just simply pool everything. And they're misguided, but they're hungry. They want somebody that's willing to say, I care about you. You don't have to go off and be by yourself with somebody else that doesn't know who cares about them. You are cared for by me. I love you. I want you to be with me. I'll touch you and I want you to touch me. I want you to my home and I want to be with you. But they found that maybe nobody cares. And it may be their fault. I don't know whose fault it is, but I'm just simply saying that we have a tendency to let ourselves develop to the place that we get out of touch with humanity. And brethren, when we do that, what's the point of religion? God came to bring us in contact with himself to where there's that communion with himself. But he also came to bring us in contact with each other to where we no longer are islands within ourselves, but we become people who are connected vitally to other people. And when they hunger, we hunger. And when they laugh, we laugh. And when they cry, we cry. And if Christianity hasn't done that to you, then you have lacked the second touch. You've lacked the greater part of it as far as this life is concerned. God expects that of you. And he weighs your relationship to him in terms of your relationship to other people. Richard Niebuhr spoke in a book that he wrote on the social sources of the church. And he said, he maintains and makes this charge, that every religious movement in the world has originated among the social outcasts, among the down and out people, among the people who are not being ministered to by those who are churchmen, the theologians, and the up and ins. But he says that every one of them, every movement began among the down and outs and the social outcasts. And then when this down and outs and all become a part of a movement, and the movement then progresses to where it evolves to a position where it's respectable and it's accepted in the community, and they start building big church buildings and doing things in a fine way, then they again forget about the common man. And the thing starts all over again. And out of that religious movement, there comes then another movement that begins to reach down and touch the common man. It seems to be a perennial, constant thing that we just simply cannot seem to break away from. We cannot seem to learn that Christ wants us to be people concerned with people. And until we've learned that, I think perhaps we've not really learned one of the basic lessons of Christianity. I wonder if there's a lesson in it for us right here. Oh, I think there is. I wonder if this church, I wonder if the church in general, and this church in particular, since we're here, I wonder if we can develop to the place that simply because of our size, it tends to alienate rather than reconcile. It tends to get us separated and fragmented, and it tends to isolate us and make islands out of us to where we are acquainted with a lot of people, but we don't really know anybody. We sit here on the same pew with people that we see from time to time, but we don't even know who they are. We don't know what their problems are. We don't really care because we've got our own problems, and we'll take care of ourselves and you take care of yourself. In our hospitality program that we've begun in the last few weeks, there are many or some who are taking part in it, but we've only had at the very most about 10 families to open their homes and say, come in. Do you realize we need 10 times that many? There are students who are becoming so frustrated over this thing, and it wasn't intended to frustrate people, but they're coming up and saying to me, if you don't hurry up and invite our row, we're coming anyway. We don't have enough room for them. But if all of us who are here together, there are some, what, 200 families here, 300 families? And yet we can't seem yet to have mustered over about 10 or at the very most 12 or 15. Somewhere along the line, we've missed it. We've got to get back to this thing and realize that until you reach out and have these people and get them into your home, no one person can do it. The elders can't do it. They need to take a greater lead. They're leading, but they need to lead more. We need to follow more. We need to get these people into our homes, and with all of us working together, we can all get them into our homes. Let's not forget to touch one another. We have a need. But there is something else. I wonder if this thing could happen to a college. I wonder if it's so that a college could start out among the down and outs at a time when it's difficult, you know, and when teachers have to just teach on a shoestring and they have to just literally gut themselves in order to serve students, and they give themselves until they're completely worn out. And then over the years, the college grows and mushrooms to the size that it is now, and now teachers don't have to really sacrifice all that much. And there are so many students around that they say, well, I can't minister to all these students, so I just won't minister to any of them. I'll just build my academic wall around me, and I won't touch any of them. Students come to me saying, I want somebody to feel like, I want to feel like somebody cares. And they come depressed, and they come wondering, why is it that you've stuck your hand out to us and said, this is where you really ought to be? And then when you get it here, somebody said they just kind of do like this, and it's, you wonder where you're standing. We need people who are willing to give of themselves, not only in an academic way in class. We need teachers who are able to say, come on to my house tonight and I'll help you. If you can't make it, you come on. We'll just go about it together. I've laid this heavy burden on you, but I'll help you move it. I'll help you pick it up with one of my fingers. Come on. We need that. I wonder if it could be possible among students that it happens. I think it could be. I think it could develop in a college where students could become so separate from people that there almost develops an antagonistic attitude among the whole student body, between the students and the faculty, and the whole thing could sour because there may be this lack of communication and lack of interchange between people. They forget that they need to touch each other in their needs. I remember when I was in college, there was an English teacher. I bless her heart. I wasn't much on poetry. And that's to my loss, and not hers. She was not a married teacher. She was a single lady. She was very proper. And whether English had done that to her or what, I don't know. But she spoke like this, Mr. Woodruff and Mr. Goodpasture and things like that. And we kind of laughed at her. And we were seniors in college, if you can excuse it. And I didn't do very well under her because I resented her, what I thought, her aloofness and her eliteness and all of that. I just didn't really have much in common with her. One day she was in the student center and I thought, well, this is ridiculous. And I went and sat down beside her, not knowing that I was going to learn what I learned. But I learned that she had a sick mother, and that she had given her whole life to taking care of that sick mother. Well, I've cried over that I misjudged her, and I regret it to this day. Once I got to know her, she was an entirely different person. Whoo, she was nice. She hadn't changed. I had just reached out and touched her and come to understand her. A girl came to my office the other day and said, I detested one of the teachers here. I said, well, sometimes we hate the things that we don't know. And she said, you're right. She said, I didn't know him. But she said on one of our campaigns, she said, he spoke at one of our evening devotionals. And he poured his heart out to us. And he told us things that I never dreamed about. She said, I was wrong about him, and now I just love him. And she says, I go around defending him before others who think that he is like that too. She says, I go around defending him now and saying, oh, you just don't know the man. She'd found herself then being able to reach out and touch him. And in touching others, we become touched by their plight and by their needs. Can you do that? Oh, it's difficult. It's not an easy job, but it's going to be necessary. I wonder if you students could be that magnanimous of character that you could reach out and touch some of the teachers that you think really are not the best teacher. Could you reach out and say, you're doing a good job? Could I help you, or could I carry your books, or could I do anything for you that might make your work more effective? Or could you just befriend them? Maybe they're insecure about their job. Maybe 101 things are bothering them. Could you try to understand them? Would you reach out and touch them? And would you let whatever animosity and antagonism that's built up, maybe, would you let it just melt away by saying, please forgive me for not trying to understand you? I wonder if those of you teachers who, if you have the attitude that I'm only going to be with you here in class, bug off, I don't have time for you, don't want you in my home, I don't want to be with you on any basis except on an academic professional basis, and anything other than that, you call me a doctor or call me a professor or call me, but don't you call me by my first name, don't get too close, would you stop that? Would you begin to reach out and touch these students? They need you. There are those of them who don't quite know where to turn, and they're coming to the counselors, and they're coming to me, and they want somebody to care. Let me tell you something else. You young men, you're failing your responsibility here. You're muffing your chance. The world looks to the male population to initiate in this thing of this association between the sexes. And you're here in a position that's absolutely prime. And yet there seems to be this hitch in your get-along to where you don't really know who you are, to the point that you're actually afraid of these gentle, lovely ladies that so populate this place. And you act like they're going to attack you. Oh, I'm serious. One boy was telling me about a man the other day, one of the boys that said he believed it would be better if they'd locked the boys in the dorms at night and let the girls roam. That's right. Well, look, that's an illness. I'm telling you what, I'm serious, that's an illness. If you don't learn how to be free in your social concourse with these ladies, with the people of the opposite sex from the time you're about 15 until you're 20 or 21, let me tell you, you just pretty well won't ever learn how. And if you can't learn here at Harding College in this community to be at ease with the opposite sex and be able to say, would you go with me and get a Coke? I'd love to just sit and visit with you. She's not going to attack you. She's expecting you to take the initiative. And when the boy does not take the initiative in a society, in any society, the boy is supposed to take the initiative and initiate this thing and get it going, and you as a girl are supposed to graciously accept. And I don't know what's the matter with you, but you need to look into it. I'm looking into it. And when I discover what it is, I'm going to talk to you about it. But you need to look at your responsibility. There ought not to be a month or a week that goes by but what every man in this college says to some lovely lady or to somebody that's not so lovely. Would you go with me and let's have lunch together, or would you go have a Coke? Tell you what, when he said that the women were taking the initiative, I told him, I said, well, I never had that problem. I didn't give them a chance to take the initiative. And all the boys I was raised with, we were always on the make. We didn't let them have a chance to. You reckon you could do that? I'll tell you what, this will be a happier place. There'll be fewer frustrated girls, and I'm not saying that the girls, I'm serious. I'm dead serious. They're frustrated. They're not angry. They're not ferocious. They're just simply frustrated. And they recognize that now's the time when they're to be developing this social awareness and all with each other. And now's the time for this social touching and contact. And I'm not talking about the erotic fondling that we see often. That's not what I'm talking about. But I think that has come simply because of the fact that there are people crying out for somebody to care for them. And when it's not done on a socially acceptable basis, then those people kind of go off into the fringe areas and they kind of lose contact with what ought to be and they overdo it. But people are crying out, please touch me, please help me. And let me tell you what, if you're a son of God, if you're a follower of Jesus Christ, you'll let it be in your life where you touch people in their social needs. Whether it be you're a teacher or a resident member who needs to open your home, or whether it be you're a student, or whether it's that you're a man and you need to initiate some contact with the opposite sex, whatever it may I urge you, imitate Jesus Christ when he said that he came and touched people and let people touch him. He's a God that touches. And I'll tell you what, I don't want to be standing before him in the day of judgment. I don't want to be standing with the rich man when he condemns him for not having touched Lazarus and provided for his needs. All he wanted was the crumbs that fell from his table, and the rich man couldn't care enough to even give him the crumbs. I don't want to be there. You look around you and find some teacher that needs your encouragement. Find some student that needs your encouragement. Find some girl that needs your encouragement. Find somebody that needs somebody to say to them, you're wanted and you're lovely and we're so glad to have you here and I'm glad to know you. And I want you to be a part of my life and I want to be a friend with you. Would you do that? This will be a better place because we'll be following the Lord. He'd be doing it. You can count on him. He'd be doing it. Let us stand and sing.